So actually, initially I prepared another talk which was more technical in the sense that I wanted to go over some of the proofs of the equations and convergence that that Eldad wrote down the other day. But anyway, I think you're probably going to do a much better mathematical treatment than I could, Jan. So maybe it's all worked out well. So since it was going to be a much more general audience, I thought I would tell you about an important application of optimal transport. In fact, this is the way we started to do optimal transport. So a few years ago, I had no idea what optimal transport was until I met Wilfred Gangbo and Rob McCann. Oh, here you are. So Wilfred explained to us what optimal transport was. And right away, we understood that it could be used for registration and comparison of shapes. So the problem was we started to go through the literature, and we couldn't find a good way of computing optimal transport maps in the case that we needed. We needed the L2 case. So really, a very influential paper was the paper of Benamou and Brignet, who basically did a control theoretic type algorithm. Unfortunately, but Eldad says that this can be done, again, it was a bit too slow. We wanted to run it on very, very large images and very, very large volumes. So we tried to come up with a technique that would work, and that really led to this program. So it wasn't that we were interested in studying abstract properties of optimal transport. Optimal transport was a technique that answered a need that we had. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain to you the background of the problem that we use optimal transport to solve, or at least to say something interesting about. As Luminitza will tell you, in image processing, you never really solve a problem. You sort of say something about it and then move on. You never really satisfy the clients. But in any event, I do think that it does say something nice about a certain class of problems, and it is becoming more and more popular for this class of problems. Okay. Oh, what happened? Oh, this is completely distorted. I see. So that's weird. All right. So what happened to my, so I actually had a slide. Can I just see, let me quickly see if these are, oh, so I guess this is just, all right. This is what I wanted to have. So first of all, but that slide has probably been misplaced. Okay, so first of all, this has been joint work. It started as a joint project with Steve Haker, then Sigurd Angenant, my mathematical collaborator, joined in. Eldad and Talsif, you've seen the work on the numerics of the problem. And I'm also going to speak about the work of Ayala Dominitz, because it turns out that you can actually do this theory on a manifold that's known, but you can actually get a computable theory on manifolds, and that's also of use in image processing. Oh, I see, now I have to go to slideshow. Boy, oh boy, Trifon, you're completely right. Okay, I should have used PDF. All right, anyway, there are some very, very basic problems in medical imaging. I've listed two, image-guided therapy and image-guided surgery. I'm not going to go through all of the various methods, but the bottom line is that, of course, one wants to develop software products that real physicians can use and distribute them. Here at UCLA, you have one of the best groups in the world doing this, the Loney Group. There are other groups as well. I'm attached to a group, in fact, which intersects with the Loney Group, NAMIC, and actually, one of the main contributors of Loney is also part of NAMIC. Arthur Toga is also on the NAMIC grant on that as well. So the types of algorithms that are needed in medical imaging are really basic algorithms in computer vision and image processing. You saw a talk the other day about segmentation. I will not discuss segmentation. I'll discuss the second main problem, registration. So the idea is that in medical imaging, in general, in computer vision, in image processing, you have data sets, for example, even in the same modality, which might be taken at different times. So for example, I'll show an example of brain surgery. I mean, we won't actually
do brain surgery. I'll just, I said I was a doctor, but I was, well, anyway. So what happens in brain surgery? So you can, suppose you want to remove a tumor. So you do an MR of the brain before the surgery. Then you perform the craniotomy, the cerebral spinal fluid pours out, and the brain sags. So the images you got of the brain before the surgery are not the images that you're seeing during the surgery. So the question is, how do you register this data? Now remember, this is your brain, it's not your knee. So if I make a mistake on the knee and you're limping a bit, at my age, I'm limping anyway. But certainly you don't want to be turned into a vegetable. So this is very, very important, this type of registration. Even more challenging is if you have different modalities. So for example, heart imagery, ultrasound, fast, noisy, MR, clean, but slow. So suppose, okay, I have an MR beforehand, let's say of the heart, and then during a procedure I have the ultrasound. How do I compare them? They look very, very different. So I want to somehow register the sets. Now, registration consists of, there's a rigid registration, right, a rotation and a translation, but there's also that infinite dimensional part, that diffeomorphism. And for a number of cases, it turns out that optimal mass transport is relevant in doing that infinite dimensional part, okay? I'm not saying in all cases, but certainly it does give an interesting way of looking at problems like this. So the way we began through a much more primitive technique, but that primitive technique through optimal mass transport can be modified into a non-primitive technique, namely the theory of conformal mappings. So the theory of conformal mappings consists of this. Many times you start with a surface, for example, the surface of a brain that you want to visualize or register. Now the brain is highly undulated, okay? It has indentations and protrusions, sulci and gyri. So how do I visualize the surface? For example, if I perform fMRI imagery, many times a lot of the activity goes on in the sulci. How do I see it? So people are interested in straightening out the brain, flattening it. And this is a subject, believe it or not. I mean, I'm sure at Loney there are all sorts of cool brain flattening techniques at MGH and all of the, I mean, just about everyone who works in this has tried this. So the question we asked ourselves 10 years ago was, well, when you flatten the brain, what do you mean? In other words, what's preserved and what's not preserved? So there's certainly no isometry from the brain to the sphere. That's an old theorem of Gauss, okay? It's even called the famous theorem of Gauss. Well, egregious theorem of Gauss. So you have to give up something. So the initial thing we gave up was area. So we looked at mappings, okay, which preserve locally the geometry, namely conformal mappings. Now, since the brain is a topological sphere, it's well known that there's a conformal mapping from the brain to the sphere, and this gives a natural way of conformally mapping it. And that's what I'm going to begin with. And then the question is, how does this become modified using optimal mass transport? So I'm not going to go through this in great detail. So conformal mappings are one-to-one. They preserve angles in terms of the fundamental form. This doesn't depend on direction, only on the point. There's a whole theory in Riemann surfaces of such surface mappings. It's called uniformization theory. The nice thing is that the brain is a topological sphere, therefore it has no moduli. There's only one brain, up to topologically and also complex analytically. So one can construct essentially, up to of course a Mobius transformation, this mapping. So how do you do it? Okay, and again, we have to give you a real algorithm, okay? So it can't just be mathematics. I have to be able to give something to a doctor or a computer scientist that can translate it into a program for a doctor. So let sigma be the brain, okay? And let S2 be the sphere. And let P be a point on the brain. So we want to construct a conformal equivalence, let's say, sending P to the North Pole. So the way you do it, in short, I don't want to waste too much time on this, is you introduce conformal coordinates. This is a detail, but basically you look at the Laplace-Beltrami operator, and if you work out the derivation of how to do this, okay, of how to construct this conformal equivalence, it's very, very easy. So near P, you're going to have a singularity, you must. You can't have a globally defined analytic function on the sphere unless it's constant. So it will have a singularity at P. So if you work this out, you get an equation like this. So you have to solve this Poisson-like equation on the surface of the brain. So what the hell does that mean? Okay, how do you do it? So the question is, what is a brain? Well, a brain, for all practical purposes, is something that you get via a segmentation algorithm, and then it's represented as a triangulated surface. Okay? So you choose your favorite segmentation algorithm, you pull out a triangulated surface, or, well, we do it on a triangulated surface. I know level surfaces are very popular here. I have no prejudice one way or another. Totally agnostic in this point of view. But in fact, most of the programs in medical imaging do give you a triangulated surface. That's simply a fact. If you use VTK in the standard products, it's triangulated. So what you want to do is you want to solve an equation like this on a triangulated surface. Even if I don't have Eldad, this is classical, right? This is finite elements, even though you're looking at me. I'm sure you're doing it, can do it 20 times as well. But nevertheless, using standard finite element techniques, which I won't bore you with, you can solve this equation, okay? Very, very easily. And you're going to get a sparse system of linear equations, which converges very, very quickly. So here are some of the results, and I'll first try to impress you with the pretty pictures, and then I'll tell you what the problems are with these results. So here's a brain gotten via a certain segmentation algorithm. The points here are painted according to mean curvature. And this is the flattened representation. So it's a one-to-one mapping of the brain to the sphere, okay? And you can see that if this is an fMRI image and we have something going on in an indentation here, it could be very clearly displayed on the surface of the sphere, and it is conformal. It does preserve angles. Now, you could imagine that the more undulated the surface is, the harder it is to flatten it, okay? The more the Gaussian curvature is changing, and this, by the way, can be made quantitative, the harder it is to flatten. But in fact, the system seems to be very robust. So this is the white matter surface of the brain, and this is the flattened representation. We've, in fact, have no numerical problems in doing this, and this has been done on lots of different brains. At Children's Hospital in Boston, this was done on neonate cortices, on the brain surfaces of newborns, with no problem. If you have a representation like this, of course, you can coordinatize the brain. So in neuroscience, a very, very big topic is making coordinates on the brain. You have so-called Talarac coordinates, which are very inexact. So in this case, since it's conformal, I can map the longitudes and latitudes of a sphere directly onto the brain. So this is really not a visualization trick. These are real coordinates. These are orthogonal coordinates directly on the brain, so you get a natural coordinate system. For the older people in the audience, maybe you're not thinking about your brains, maybe your bladders. We could have a break if anyone needs it. So this is for cancer, bladder thickening. You can play the same game. We've done it as well for the heart. So this is the left ventricle. This is the so-called polar map. So why do I need optimal mass transport? Here I'm getting very nice mappings. I mean, I can take brain one, map it to a sphere, brain two, map it to a sphere, and now I get away with comparing the two brains. The problem is, okay, that there's no preservation of area here, of course. The areas can get miserably distorted, and in fact they will, right? Near that point P, things will stretch miserably. So it's an answer, okay? It's pretty. It is useful for some purposes, but again, it's not quite what we need. What we really want is something that will preserve area and angles as best as possible, but there's no free lunch. Can't have both. Igor, I know you're looking at me in a disappointed way. What can I do, my friend? You can't have both, okay? If the brain were a perfect sphere, or maybe the brain of a dolphin, it would be smoother. What can I do? Well, there are surfaces, though, that it almost works for, okay, which are actually quite interesting in medical imaging. And these are tubular surfaces of the body. For a tubular surface, I can almost have my cake and eat it too by doing this type of procedure. So after all, we're solving the Dirichlet problem, right? That's what I did essentially on the surface of the brain. So now I'm going to do it on a tube, okay? And I'm basically going to map the tube onto some sort of rectangular domain onto the plane. I mean, I'm going to cut in a special way to make sure the function is increasing, and I'm going to solve the Dirichlet problem here. I'm not going to give you the details. It's very, very easy to do. I believe it's classical. Okay, so you can now take a tubular surface and flatten it. And if you change coordinates, you can do it without distortion. What do I mean without distortion? Well, again, I want to get to the optimal mass transport, but the idea is as follows. If I flatten it and I fly through the surface, I can make a fly-through path in such a way that everywhere I'm looking, there's no distortion. In other words, I see the object and it's not deformed. Where I'm looking, of course, if I'm looking down there, it is distorted. But where I'm looking, it's perfect, okay? So basically, I'm going through the tubular structure, looking down. Wherever I look along my flight path, everything is perfect. And that's very, very easy to do. We were lucky that tubes are developable surfaces in the body, and that's what we did. So what are the interesting tubes that you might want to fly through?
My throat.
Wrong.
Ear.
Wrong. Okay, someone older. Older person. Go ahead. Oh, no, not in you. I mean. Well, what? Well, who has had a fly through? Why lower in the body? So those of us over 50 have had fly-throughs, quite unpleasant fly-throughs. Thank God it's 4 hours after lunch. And that's the colonoscopy, okay? So the colonoscopy, sorry, the endoscopy is a type of fly-through. And, well, I'm not gonna say anything more about it. So, so in any event, one of the most important tubes, tubular structures in the body, is the colon. And it's highly recommended that the colon be examined, I mean, in all patients over 50. The way it's done is it's done via an endoscopy. You can imagine that in order to do this, the colon has to be clean. The substance is called golightly. And then basically, essentially, someone flies through the colon. Now, in most cases, there's really no problem doing this, but there is about 10% of the population that have very sensitive colons. The colons could be perforated with the actual fly through, or the colons can become quite inflamed. So for that 10%, which is actually quite large, one tries to do a virtual colonoscopy. So what's a virtual colonoscopy? You basically do it in a CT. So you have a series of CT images, 2D, and what happens is that the physician basically sits, the radiologist sits and looks image by image, okay, and tries to detect polyps. Now you can imagine that this is boring as hell. I remember sitting with a radiologist, and at some point, you know, after 3 hours of doing this, he looks at me and he says, this is a job for someone with no imagination. And you're trying to find, you know, and you see indentations and you're trying to guess. So the idea is to try to automate this virtual colonoscopy. Okay. So this is, I'm just giving statistics about colon cancer. And it's really one of the most preventable colon cancers. By the way, with the American diet, I don't know about the European diet, but with the American diet, more than one-third of the population over 60 has polyps. That doesn't mean they have colon cancer, but they have polyps, and the polyps should be treated, okay? So it's a very, very large number, a very, very large part of the population. All right, so here are some of the problems. Proper preparation of the bowel, how to ensure complete inspection. So the answer that's been provided is the so-called non-distorting colon flattening program, which I'm going to demo. Now this is a real program. This is a product that was sold and licensed to Siemens, okay, for doing this automatic navigations and fly through the colon. It's very easy to do. You get an automatic path. You don't have to compute a medial axis. It's very, very simple. And again, it's a solution of some linear equations. All right, so what's the idea? You want to simulate a pathologist's approach, no navigation, and to visualize the entire surface. So this was tested a lot more. This was from the initial screening. I mean, this was several years ago when we did this project, but I'll show you some results from, I'm not going to go through all 53 patients, I'm just going to show you some typical cases of how it was as good as a human user. This, by the way, is how the flattened colon looks. How is the program going to work? So this represents the mean curvature, the idea that a polyp is essentially a mushroom. It's a little sphere on a stalk. So the Gaussian curvature is going to be higher than the Gaussian curvature of the colon surface. So basically, we're looking for points of very, very high Gaussian curvature on the surface of the colon. And here's the fly path. I'll show you the whole thing. So through this center line, there's no distortion as we're going through. It's perfect. And, well, here's it. Now, as part of the product, by the way, so here's a suspicious spot. Of course, the radiologist doesn't want to see it in this cartoon way like this. So you can click on this image, and then you can see the real CT images. And it will tell you if the radiologist believes it's really a polyp or not. In this case, it really is. So.
It's interesting you choose the color scheme.
Well, actually, the color scheme was chosen by a student there, Sven, I should say, who was 18 years old and I'm sure had absolutely a perfect colon. Yeah.
What they see.
Exactly. And I should say that this is not a colon of anyone that I know, so. I don't want people looking at me in a strange way. So. All right. So I'll go through these quickly because I want to get through the optimal mass transport. Actually, I'm already. So basically, you can take all of the common cases. It really worked very, very well in discovering these for all of the standard problems. And this is how the fly-through looks. So this is a polyp. You then basically reconstruct it, and you basically fly through as if you're flying through a tunnel. That's what it is. So here's a polyp. Notice it doesn't get stuck flying through this. Here's another polyp, and you come out the other end. Just to put this in perspective, from segmentation, CT segmentation to reconstruction, it can be done in less than half an hour. I'm always fond of telling a story that at Emory, we, you know, they have this $2,000 executive examination. They do your blood and full body CT and everything like that. So we did do the colon of a billionaire. He's the head of a company headquartered in Atlanta. And he gave up eating red meat in his 20s. He was about 72 years old when we did his colon. He had the colon of an 18-year-old boy. Think about it when you're eating your red meat. I'm not looking at you, Wolfen, in particular. I'm just a little bit of health advice here as part of the lecture. Okay. So, the question is, how can this be improved? And as I mentioned to you, and here's where the optimal mass transport comes in. So the problem with the brain, and even with the visualization of the polyp, if you're looking farther down, is of course that there's a distortion, even a tremendous distortion in size. So the question is how I can try to start with something conformal and make it something area preserving. Now, of course, saying that a mapping is area preserving or volume preserving is not saying a hell of a lot because it can distort the shape miserably. Okay, kinematic mixing is area preserving, and certainly the shape changes dramatically. On the other hand, there's a large literature on area preserving maps, and the area preservation can be taken in the sense of even a Monte Contadovich. You can take an arbitrary positive function here. So the one of the classical results is a result of Moser. Okay, so this is a volume or area form. If I have two compact manifolds with volume forms, and if I assume they're diffeomorphic, and if the total volumes add up, it's exactly a Monte Contadovich type condition, then I can find a diffeomorphism which is area preserving, volume preserving. That's exactly what this means, right? I take one differential form into another. And in fact, the Moser proof is constructed. It's basically in the same homotopy class. So if I start somehow with a diffeomorphism, for example, a conformal mapping, I can plug it into the Moser machine and get one which is area or volume preserving. Okay? Very, very easy to do. At one point, I thought, boy, this is a great theorem. That's it. The Moser map is not very pretty. He's a great mathematician, but it does. You know, if you think about it, you don't want to distort the grid too much, right? You start with a nice grid. Yeah, I mean, you're a numerical analyst, and you don't want to distort it too badly. It doesn't have a very, very good effect. By the way, again, you can use finite elements to solve this, okay? I'm not going to go through the proof. It's actually very, very easy. It can be explicitly constructed via PDE. So another attempt, and this, in fact, but it's the subject of another lecture. It's very, very close to optimal mass transport. Is you can try something like this, okay? But you can try to mix area preservation and angle preservation as follows. So what do I do, okay, with the conformal mapping? So basically, you solve the Dirichlet problems. So you have the Dirichlet integral, right? And I'm looking for critical points of the Dirichlet functional. But I'm doing it essentially over L2 functions. So instead of doing it over L2 functions, I can do it over area preserving functions, right? I can project onto that set of functions and try to get area preservation with minimal distortion. It actually leads to something very, very close to the equations, what Eldad called the AHT equations in this case, but I'm gonna derive it in a completely different manner. Okay. Yeah, and here's the construction, which I won't go through. All right. Yeah, I have enough time, I hope. So, registration and mass transport. So I already defined what the registration problem is. So the idea is we want some sort of similarity measure between images. And the number of cases that similarity measure that makes sense, and I'll argue it for a certain class of imagery, could be based on mass transport. So I'm not going to read everything here, but the idea is that the key is this similarity measure, And many times this is formulated as an optimization problem. We're going to propose the use of Munch-Kontadovich for the similarity measure. So yeah, here I'm preaching to the choir. This is for a more engineering audience. But mass transport is a major area. It was proposed by Gaspar Munch in 1781, the measure theoretic formulation, Kontadovich, and it's a really popular area. It's made some of us rich and famous, hasn't it? At least we're invited to UCLA. Okay. So again, I guess I don't have to do this. Just very, very quickly to set up the notation. So if I assume that the mass-preserving mapping M is smooth, then it satisfies this Jacobian equation. Of course, as was pointed out by several of the speakers, this has lots of solutions, many of which are not very, very useful, most of which aren't. So the idea when we introduce the Kontadovich-Wasserstein metric is we want to find a good mapping. So the way I look at this integral is I'm looking at the distortion, how much it distorts, how far away it is from the identity, but of course weighted, weighted by these densities. And the implement is taken over all mass-preserving mappings. So here I'm actually plagiarizing one of Wilfred's papers. Do you remember you said this in one of your papers, Wilfred? It's actually your sentence. I wouldn't have said it if you weren't in the audience. I thought you might jump up. I would have. I've actually had this in numerous talks and never mentioned it before. But you have to be careful who's sitting here. So I really like this sentence a lot. An optimal map wouldn't exist, chooses a map with a preferred geometry like the Riemann mapping theorem in the plane. Or okay, and you should look at p equals 2 here. So here again, I'm setting up the notation. This is the Jacobian equation. So while Dodd mentioned this, what our approach was. And so this was the original approach given by Steve Haker and myself. And there were two different flows. I proposed one flow, Steve proposed another flow. Actually, it turns out that Steve's flow is easier to implement, even though for the manifolds now we've gone to my flow, which turns out to be easier there. But both flows are based exactly on the same principle. So I'm going to do it in R2. So you start with some mapping, okay? Some mapping, I mean, and it works in complete generality. Okay, from a domain in R2 to a domain in R2. So you can look at it as a vector field, right? You can look at it as a vector field. So I can write it as a curl-free part and a divergence-free part. Okay? This is standard, the Helmholtz decomposition. So the trick is to try to push this vector field around via a mass-preserving map S in such a way as to kill the curl, okay? So the optimal mass-preserving map is curl-free. So we basically want to try to remove curl. I want to kill this part. So in the end, you get a factorization like this. This is the polar factorization. Were you the one who introduced the polar factorization? All right, so here he is. So basically, it's exactly to try, it's really a method, okay, of polar factorizing the map using a gradient flow. That's the whole trick, okay, behind this. So we have to define a proper gradient flow to kill curl, to get the mapping. So you basically start, and this is what Eldad was complaining about the other time in these computations, by, and I have to say, we have all of the computations with all of the details, and don't let them tell you differently. So this is, okay, so this is the mass preservation part, this is pushing it around. Now, using the mass preserving property of the mapping, one gets an equation like this, very easy to compute, where zeta is equal to this, and because this is mass-preserving, the divergence is equal to zero. Now, people in fluid flows, I swear to God, tell me, since this is mass-preserving, this is obvious. Honestly, I have no idea why. I mean, you can compute it. Is this obvious? It's obvious. See? Tell El Dad that it's obvious, okay? He says it's obvious. It wasn't obvious to me, I admit it, but it's, in fact, it is divergence free. So what do? So we set up, okay, a gradient flow. Okay, we're going to informize with respect to these mappings. You can think of this as simply the square, if you like, but it can be any C2 function. Because of the mass-preserving property, you change variables. So now it's very, very easy to take the first variation. You play a little bit all the time using the mass-preserving property. You change variables again, and you get a result like this. So remember, we're going to try to push down, to try to decrease this functional, but we have to be sure that we're keeping the mass-preserving property at all times. So what you would do, of course, is essentially you're going to choose this equal to that. That would be your first choice. Now, why do I have this fudge term? Why do I have the fudge term? Because I have to make sure that the divergence is equal to zero. You see what I'm saying? This might not be enough. I need this term, okay, this fudge term, to make sure at each time I need that divergence of zeta is equal to zero. And this, of course, is to keep myself in the volume. So this leads exactly to the following system of equations. This, and now you exactly take what the divergence-free part is going to be. You force this condition. And this, of course, is to make sure that you're kept in the domain. So now, don't forget, we're going to apply this to images. Everything for us is either a cube or a square. So you get the following equation that Eldad wrote down. At optimality, it's known that you have this. And as he mentioned, there are various types of convergence results. One can prove for the unregularized flow that if you start from C1 alpha initial data, you at least get short time existence. If you smooth the flow, then you can get an asymptotic result. It remains C1 alpha for as long as you like. And this is in the paper with Siegert. Okay. In the case of the L2 problem, you get this. And this is what I mentioned before. So this equation is very well, I shouldn't say that. Sorry. This equation is really hard to I'm scared now. So Steve Haker implemented this equation. Eldad hated the implementation. Eldad also replaced all of these by curls, okay, and crosses and stuff like that. Anyway. This can be implemented, and I admit he has the best one. But let me show you some results of how this looks. Give me five. What? I think I have 5 more minutes, don't I? Change minute. Ah, okay. Fatti bene, merci. Okay. All right. We speak in our language. Okay. So anyway, I'm really happy you're in the audience. Actually, okay. So anyway. This is not serious, okay? It's simply a way of showing you how it's going to look of mapping one mass to another. So, come on. Thank you very much. I'll conclude here. Come on, the grid is one. No. So, we start out with an initial bad. This is bad, okay? This is the bad area-preserving mapping. So what we do essentially is we basically construct the mass-preserving mapping. You first do it in the x-axis, and then you do it along the y-axis, and you put it together. And the result isn't very good. So if you look, this has a lot of curl in it. Now, we start with this as the initial mapping. You start to iterate. Again, Eldad was reporting 3 or 4 iterations. In the old days, we were doing hundreds of them. But you can see that the curl has been greatly reduced, and the grid has been greatly straightened. And of course, you can morph one from the other now. You can actually give the optimal transfer from one mass to the other. And that's that. So this is the optimal mapping. Again, this isn't a visualization trick. It's really, if you like, a geodesic path with respect to this measure within the space of mass-preserving mappings. So the fact that it's such a pretty formula, this I got out of the paper of Benamou and Brunier, but Rob McCann claims it's in his thesis, so I really don't know who. So I give everyone credit, but yeah, we're all friends here. All right, but anyway, this is what it turns out to be, this warp. Now, something more serious is the brain sag I mentioned. By the way, all of these intermediate images are mathematics. Okay? These are all mathematics. We have the initial image, we have the final image, and we're morphing one to the other, deforming it one to the other. So this is exactly the brain sag that I mentioned to you. And by the way, this was done in 3 dimensions. I'm just showing you a 2D slice. And you can see that the parts, okay, where one expects to have the most deformation, that is the case. So why does it make sense for an image like this? The reason it makes sense is that what's MR imagery? It's proton density, okay? You're basically looking, the intensity is related exactly to a density. And so physically, this makes sense. And in any event, some of the images I think that Eldad showed, and if you're interested, Tausif has a lot of cool stuff, you'll see that it does make a lot of sense with imagery like this. And this is the 3D grid illustrating the brain sag. Now, this is something that another student did, Lei Zhu. This is a beating heart. Now, again, all that we had was the systolic and the diastolic, the biggest part of the ventricle, and then it contracts. Everything else is mathematics here, okay? Everything else is mathematics. Visually, it looks, I'm reluctant, you know, I know Charlie Peskin, a number of people have spent their whole damn lives, you know, what to call their whole life working, but it does visually, it does make a lot of sense. A flame expanding. Okay? All that you had was the initial, all that you had was the end. Clouds moving. In each case, this mass preservation makes sense. This is one of Tausif's very nice images, solar flare. Oh, solar flare. Let me jump get it again. That's interesting why it looks like a solar flare. I'll do it again. Hurricane Dean. I don't know why it's doing this. Yeah, I guess that. It looks like Hurricane Dean. In other words, again, the mass preservation makes. By the way, for weather fronts like this, Monge Kontadovich is one of the things used. I mean, if I believe people who predict the weather, etc., this probably makes physical sense. Now, in the case of the warping and the correction for area distortions, well, here's an example. So this now is the conformal flattening. And you can see that this is the size of the polyp here. And you can see that it's greatly shrunk. But now you can use Monge Kontadovich to correct this distortion exactly. So what do? You conformally flatten the surface. You define your initial density to be the Jacobian, the determinant of the Jacobian of the inverse flattening map. This to be some constant depending on the total area. So the Monge Kontadovich optimal map, taking one to the other, corrects the area. And then you compose the two. So you get an exact area preserving map. So this is the area preserving map. And you can see, and we've actually measured the angles, the distortion really isn't very bad at all. Here's an example of flattening a piece of white matter. This is the correction with the Monge Kontadovich, you can see that the distortion is really not very bad at all, and you guarantee perfect area preservation. So probably, I don't want to say this is the best you can do, but it's an extremely reasonable answer. Well, what about doing this directly on a manifold? So let me share with you very briefly. So this is PhD work of another student, Ayala Dominitz, okay, of developing algorithms directly on surfaces. Very, very similar. So we have a two-dimensional surface. This is the Riemannian metric. Okay. So this is the function that we're taking. This is the standard formula for the area form of the metric. And now this is exactly the family. The notation has changed, but you get the idea. So the upper T simply means at time T, and this was that family of diffeomorphisms, okay? Those that preserve this measure. And this is the associated vector field. I'm going to show you exactly what these look like. So this is how they're moving, okay? And then exactly the same type of computation, the UTs, these maps, have to satisfy this transport equation, while the functional, I'm basically repeating what I had before, evolves in this way. So now I'm again going to write down, okay, this divergence-free condition. So I apologize for really sloppy notation. So M naught is mu naught, what it was previously, because I used here mu for the integral. So please forgive me, okay? But M naught is M naught is mu naught. Okay? So this is the divergence-free condition that we need, okay? So in order to have this measure-preserving property, we need this. So if I'm going to take a two-dimensional surface, okay, I have to write down how a general divergence-free vector field looks on a surface. So that's given. I will admit I was once a mathematician, and I did take this stuff from Phil Griffiths, but don't tell anyone, because I'm sort of embarrassed by it. But anyway, it turns out that a divergence vector-free field on a surface has this form. So this is the standard counterclockwise rotation map, which Eldad would write as a curl. And this is a Hamiltonian, and this is a harmonic vector field, okay? And I'm simply writing down what characterizes it. So I have not used the fact that I'm dealing with a sphere yet. Everything is on a completely general surface. And in fact, Ayala is now extending her results to a general surface. So we know what the dimension of the space of harmonic vector fields on the surface is. It's exactly the dimension of the first Remco cohomology group. Therefore, it's 2G dimensional. If G is equal to 0, this term vanishes, and I get something that looks like what I had before. So the A vanishes in that case. All right, so we have this. We plug in. You get this. Same argument as we had before. You integrate by parts, and one gets an expression like this. So to obtain a gradient flow, of course, same game, you can exactly make your Hamiltonian have this form. All right, so let's write down numbers and expressions. The case of the sphere. So how does the metric, how does the distance look on a sphere? Well, we know how it looks on a sphere. It's exactly the angle, right? I mean, it's basically the geodesic distance, you know, is that great circle angle. So here is the functional. I can write down the intrinsic derivative. Here's a cross product for you, Eldad, because I like you. And one gets this system of equations. So this, I'm taking the linear cost functional. I hope that I've written the quadratic down. This is the quadratic cost functional. They're very similar, okay? So these are the equations that I have to implement. Ayala did a very, very smart thing. She basically used the spherical wavelet basis to implement this flow. I'm not saying that it competes well with what anyone else did, but it actually has nice results. All right, yeah. Oh, I even have the implementation. Well, I only have cinch minute. Oh, but all right, anyway, you choose a nice basis here, and you compute, okay? And let me just show you what the results are. So this is mapping, okay, the map of a world, of the globe, onto a vase. Area preserving, okay? And it's directly, okay? It's absolutely directly, okay? I mean, we do a sphere onto this, and this is the optimal Munch-Kontorovich map. Now, you can use it for texture mappings. So this is, whatchamacallit, it's, well, you can see what it is. So a puzzle, you know, from the sphere mapped onto the bust of some important person. Now, just to finish, we have our GPU wizard here, Talsif. He has sped up these algorithms tremendously. What was taking us an hour and a half now is done in minutes, okay, on the GPU. And we've given him more memory now. Whatever he wants, he gets. Just tell me what you need. Let's do the damn thing, and everything is cool. Ah, this was actually the lecture I initially wanted to present with describing the solution at point blank. You can read the paper. Actually, it's very interesting because there's an ODE and we have to fix that, but it's hardly singular, so you have to find it. All right, anyway, the deformations of surfaces. This can be used for many other purposes, for example, optical flow. I really think optimal mass transport is a great technique. Once again, I was not an optimal transport person looking for a solution. I was a simple engineer looking for a technique, okay? Really, a simple engineer. Had there been another technique out there, we would have used that technique very happily. But many times, interesting mathematics comes from really applied problems. So on that note, I will...